Episode 282 of the Pilot the Pilot podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics? Then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot. The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app.
All right, so I'm Steve, also known as Flight Chops on the internet, but you can call me Steve.
Aviation, what is going on? And welcome back to the Pilot to Pilot podcast. Today's episode is a podcast that was recorded at Oshkosh, so EAA Air Venture. We have, who everyone should know, Steve from Flight Chops, and it was great having him on. I remember, he might not remember this, but I reached out to him way back in the beginning. So to be able to get this up and going, it's kind of like a big full circle moment for me. So I was very excited to have him on. We touch a lot about his story, and we even talk about how awesome of a family he has, and just the support that it takes to do this and to be a full-time content creator, pilot, and also be a dad as well. So shout out to Steve. He's killing it. If for some reason you live under a rock and you don't follow Steve, go to Flight Chops right now, subscribe to him on all platforms, and check him out on Patreon because he makes some great content. Aviation hats are back. I know we've talked about this before. Pilot to Pilot hats. You can find the link in the description below. They're the best hats we've ever had. So check out the hats. They're great. And shout out to everyone that has bought hats already. I look forward to seeing them on the road, and thank you so much for tagging them on Instagram. So it's really cool. But Aviation, I want to keep it longer. We got a big episode here. So without any further ado, here's Steve from Flight Chops. Steve, what's going on, man? Welcome to the Pilot to Pilot podcast.
Right on. Glad to be here.
Yeah. It's been a long time coming. I feel like it's been long overdue. So I'm happy to have you on.
Cool.
Yeah. Sweet. Let's get into it, man. First question I always ask is why aviation? For you personally, what was it about this that got you into it?
Yeah, I mean, I always knew I wanted to fly. It was just a question of how and when. So as a five-year-old, I have memories of just looking up and knowing. I think that's what you'll find with a lot of pilots probably. I just didn't have, like, ironically, I did have a grandfather that flew Spitfires in World War II. So I heard the stories sort of secondhand. He died when I was pretty young. My father, I think, probably wanted to be a pilot, but never really pursued it. So that was kind of the end of it. There was no family friend or uncle or anybody to help me get into it. So I kind of knew I wanted to do it. I started with Air Cadets when I was 12. In Canada, they will fund your training for gliding and power if you're in like the top 3% or something and attend every single parade and have your boots polished.
So you attended every single parade and got
that? No, I did not. So I failed at that. I didn't have supportive enough parents to drag me there all the time. And it became clear, like, if you missed a single parade or whatever, you're out of the running for the scholarship. And that's all I was there for, I'm going to be honest. I wasn't really interested in military boot polishing stuff. That just wasn't for me. No offense to anybody in the military. It just wasn't for me. I kind of wanted to grow my hair and, you know, high school.
Get the chops, right?
Get the chops going, yeah. So that was when I was 12, 13. So that stream kind of died there. But then I did the math on it back in those days in the 90s is when I got my license. It was about $3,000 to $4,000 is what it was going to cost to do it in those days. It ain't like that now. So I did the math and realized I can just get a job, save that money instead of doing all these hours at the Air Cadets and then fund it myself. So I saved all that money, got the money. I was 15, but then there were girls in cars. So I had a 1985 Volkswagen Scirocco.
Okay.
Took away that money.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the hell out of that car. That was when I fell in love with sports coupes. And then I was 18, 19, went to university. Then I was in student mode, had some money, and I decided I just got to do this. So I fitted in between first and second year university and just crunk. Like, I basically did gliding. There's the wall of fire or something out there. I did gliding to start for the summer, got solo, did a couple solo hours, and then moved right into power and finished my power in that winter of 95. So 96, between first and second year university, I got my license.
It's always funny. There always seems to be something standing in the way at all times that you could just be like, I'm not going to do it because of this. Girls, cars, whatever, maybe money in some cases. But there's always something. There's always something else you could be doing.
Yeah.
Do you wish you would have done it earlier? Or are you like, dang, I should have started at 16?
Okay, so at the time, I was 21, 22. I remember thinking, like, I missed the opportunity. I'm late on this. That sucks, whatever. Looking back now, I'm like, come on, that was fine. Like, those kids that get it done that early, all the power to them, they're not doing it alone. they have the kind of support that people like me didn't have. So as a kid pulling it off when I did a 21-year-old funding it myself, all myself, yeah, I'm going to give myself credit now. That kid back then, I felt like I did this late because then I ran into the situation where I got it. And I have this distinct memory of going to the diner that I always went to after a lesson on the way home from the airport, ordering that burger that I always have and slapping down my temporary certificate. And it had been a tough day because the wind was high in the morning and I was always nervous during, like, you know, a flight test. You're pretty nervous. So I didn't really eat much. So the examiner was hanging around and they were like, well, it's probably too windy to go now, but if you hang around, we can probably do it in a couple hours. I was like, great, I'm not going to eat for another couple hours. But yeah, so I did my test, like fighting through like a hypoglycemic attack the whole time.
That's the perfect time to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't eaten, right? Because I just couldn't. So I got it done, sat down, ordered that burger. They slid it across to me. I looked at it like, I can't even, like, you know, I'm so far beyond having not eaten today. I can't even eat that. But then I looked at the license and I thought, I never thought about this moment. Like, I have it and now I'm broke. I can't afford to maintain currency and I'm out of money. And now what? That moment hit me like a ton of bricks. And that was kind of a weird, like, anticlimactic moment of achieving this goal, having not thought, what am I doing when I get it? And then years went by where I maintained absolute minimum currency for the insurance for renting. Like, they had a 0.5 per 30-day requirement. There was a lot of months where I had 0.6 logged. And I mean, a couple of years where I had like 6 hours logged, you know? So it was a tough go to keep current for that.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up an interesting point, right? Like, people are like, all right, I'm gonna go get my private, but they don't ever think about what they're gonna do once they get their private. Yeah. It's like, well, it still costs money to go fly. It's like, all right, you just spent now, what, like $10,000-$15,000 for a private, maybe something like that, possibly. That's a lot of money. If you don't have anything else saved up from then, you're not going to go fly. So what do you do?
Yeah.
So that's a good point. I've never really thought of it like that.
Because I didn't want to go commercial. I knew I just wanted to fly for fun. So connecting it to only fun meant I need to have fun money for this, which I don't have. So in those days, it was a struggle to stay current.
When you were at the beginning of this was 90s-ish?
Mid-90s.
Mid-90s. YouTube wasn't really a thing. Video.
The internet was barely a thing.
Video, not really a thing. So never in a million years did you ever think this was going to be like a content creator. This is how we'll make money one day.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker. That's a good point, though. I was in film school. That's what I was doing. So film school and flying were two separate things. Film was work. Flying was fun. And I didn't even have video of myself flying because the few times I would take someone with a camera, which would have been like a little handheld video camera in those days, it would be garbage, unusable crap, right? They would come back with like, I got your landing. And then it's like, I can't even make anything out of that.
You're squinting.
There was no mounted camera, set it and forget it stuff that GoPros became, you know, a decade or more later. So in the early days, I had no way to see or debrief my flying. So I think when the GoPro became a thing, the set it and forget it tiny camera that can roll for an hour, that was game changing for me from a debrief perspective. And I used it to improve significantly when I couldn't really afford to get an instructor to fly with me. I didn't need to legally, or, you know, I had maintained my insurance requirements, but I was seeing sloppiness that I was fixing by debriefing with video.
When you were through the private, I guess, how long did you have just private pilot, just 0.5 before it became you could actually fly for fun or continue it a little bit more?
I mean, don't get me wrong. I flew for fun with those minimum hours.
Right.
No, you said, but like I was looking back on it, I'm like, man, was I like not current or safe, right? I mean, I was barely legal. So it's like that, to get to a point where I was proficient like I am now, it took a while because I was doing the repeating the same flight around Toronto where I was from. I was doing the city tour again and again, kind of rent a plane, take some friends, do that same flight again that blows their minds because we're over the city, it's beautiful, whatever. And I was doing that flight like in my sleep, feeling like I'm not getting better. I'm not doing anything different. I don't really have access to anything to do anything different. It really was that the local airport outside of the city had this beat up old Warrior that had a modified constant speed prop. That's like my first access to the Blue Knob. And I thought, let's do that. So just to change it up and just get access to a Warrior, fly constant speed a little bit and just kind of, I like manual transmission. So this feels like I'm adding that variable to it. That changed things a little bit. And then right around that time, flight chops started to become a thing because I started sharing my debriefs because I also started tailwheel because there was a beat up old Super Cub in the hangar that I saw that wasn't flying, but it was insured. And my instructor was like, well, you want to blow the dust off that thing and bring it out because no one's flying it. And I was like, hell yes, I do. Yeah,
let's see if the engine still works.
Yeah. So, I mean, that changed everything. And that was around 2014.
Okay. Your film career before flying, what did that look like? Like film school, what did you have some big projects?
Yeah,
what?
Well, so I did my film school in the 90s and started with music videos and commercials and stuff like that into the early, like late 90s, early 2000s. And it was getting pretty cool. We were shooting film, music videos and stuff, having pretty good budgets. A thing happened in the early, I guess it was probably around 2000, where there was a writer strike and an actor strike at the same time. Essentially, the birth of reality TV happened, where Mark Burnett was like, what can I do without writers or actors? And that's when Survivor became a thing. And at the same time, there was digital video really happening in a big way. Small cameras, shoot lots of footage, don't worry about the tapes. There's none of that crap to worry about with beta being expensive or any of that. Digital editing was super easy. It wasn't like tape to tape, linear. Like they were now non-linear editing became a thing, which was new then. So they would fire an army of camera guys at a thing, bring back this mountain of footage and a team of editors, which is attack it. There was no more like cinematographers, not worrying about lighting, just get it, wait, whatever, figure it out later, fix it in post. You'd hear that a lot. I was kind of streaming in the direction of being a cinematographer. So that was kind of disappointing from an artistic perspective. So the volume of work went up because it became reality TV for editors and shooters, but the volume of work for like cinematographers kind of went down because it was like, you want to shoot? That's cool. Come out and shoot, grab a camera, but none of this is art. So that was what my work started looking like. And I started working on some shows. Some of them were aviation themed, so I thought this would be cool, but it always gravitated toward the reality TV drama. It was like you could take any topic and slap on the same format of just humans fighting over a stupid thing. And that's kind of what it became. So that was kind of the motivation to make the flying content that I wanted to see, where I just wanted to share my debriefs. I didn't intend to be on camera, frankly. I was going to do POV stuff and just show the panel, show the controls, show whatever I figured out or fixed or something. Didn't care if it got views. It was just me sharing with my friends some debriefs and getting better in the flying community. It was one of my director friends who said, if you're going to do this, you got to put the U in YouTube. Turn one of the cameras around. I really hesitated to do it. But around that time, I was doing my steerman training. And it was pretty cool to be in a steerman. So I was like, all right, fine. It'll be fun to see my reaction to that. But I saw some really good value in seeing where I was looking with my eyeballs. So part of the debrief became that my face was a valuable part of it. I could tell I was making a mistake by fixating during landing. I should have been cross-checking my two pie slices on the sides and then just looking at one. And I was kind of like looking ahead, trying to use my peripheral for both. And I fixed the problem and trying to land the steerman just by seeing where I was looking. So that was an interesting learning moment that it actually was a valuable shot. I never was about the selfie, but that also ultimately became the thing. And the chops was just a joke. Like I have a weak chin. I never really intended to have that mustache. It was a total joke. And it was one of my artist friends who like drew the logo because I play the drums. So, you know, chops in music is just when you work on a thing, practicing. A lot of people don't know that's what it really means. So the chops is like a mustache. It just was like this perfect kind of metaphor for practicing. So that's where flight chops. It wasn't even a thought out thing. It was just organic. It just was what we called it. It was a joke. And then 10 years later, I'm still doing it.
That's hilarious. Where does family come in all this? Wife, kids, yeah. Where does all this kind of fit in?
So the wife and the house and the kid all kind of happened between 2005 and 2009. And that was a time when I didn't fly. So I literally lost currency around the time when we bought the house, which was the first thing we did, which I think is more stressful than getting married, honestly.
You're not wrong.
Although having a baby is up there.
Yeah.
But then we got a puppy, and I got to say that was harder than a baby, but I would have been lucky. My kid was easy. She slept, no problem. The dog, oh my God. Puppy. Don't recommend puppies if you want to sleep or go to restaurants or travel. But anyways, between 2005, 2009, that was where that whole life gets in the way thing happened. And it actually was getting back. We live somewhere near the edge of a control zone, so there's low planes flying a lot, and I'm always looking up, and my wife noticed that. And she was like, you know, you got to get back into this. I can tell you feel like you've lost this thing. I was about to lose it, really, because in Canada, it's probably similar here. If you don't fly for 5 years, you got to go through some hoops to get it back.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you have to log PIC within 5 years. If you don't, there's a process that the government's involved in to get it back.
You don't want that.
I don't want that. Yeah. So, but if you do log PIC in those 5 years, you're good. So, but I'm not going to just jump in and log PIC after 4.5 right. years not flying. So I went and got a local instructor, went through everything kind of voluntarily to get solo again, to get that PIC check box back in my logbook. So I did it. I refreshed it right in 2009, whatever it was, just before it expired, but immediately faced that same problem of like, okay, well, I'm back to city tours or whatever. So that's when I found that other school with the constant speed prop and the tailwheel and all that stuff led to doing a lot of different types of flying.
It's funny how your wife's kind of like, a lot of people say their wife would keep them from flying, but in reality, your wife is kind of like, what are you doing, man? Come on, go do this. Like, I'm tired of seeing you look at these airplanes, go fly them.
Yeah. That was cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's cool to have like a motivator and someone that can push you all the way when you need it.
Yeah.
When you made the decision, or I don't know if you had to make the decision or if it was just time to move on and start your own content and kind of go full on that, was family concerned with that? Like, obviously you have a career, right? You are doing film, you're doing music videos, all the above, reality TV show. Was it tough to walk away from that? Or did you make sure you had the income before you could fully walk away
from it? So the answer to that is, I guess my wife was involved with that one too. I have a distinct memory of working on a reality show where it was about renovation, whatever. I was sitting there I've been told by one of the producers, there's a scene where they have the fight and of course the drama. Can you find it? It's when they're doing the living room painting, whatever. And all this footage, I'm going through all this footage. And my wife walked in at one point and she was like, oh my God, you have been watching paint dry all day. And I was like, you are right. I can't find this crap they told me to find. So I called one of the camera guys and he was like, yeah, that was such a big fight they had. It was during lunch. None of us were rolling. So I'm like, the producer thinks because it happened and they had 20 camera guys, they must have captured it. I was so frustrated by this like waste of energy and time, and it really solidified, what am I doing? So I was already doing flight chops. I think I just decided to work harder on it, but I didn't quit any of my other contracts. I just decided, let's just really put some pro. Initially, like the first videos of the channel were, I had a rule to myself of how long I was going to work on them because it was in my spare time. I can't do work that is work for nothing in my spare time. So I worked a little harder at those days, but I didn't plan on it becoming a sustainable thing. And I didn't have any revenue stream intentionally. Like, I didn't turn on YouTube ads. Like, I had 100,000 subscribers before I turned on YouTube ads. And it was only because I got kind of told that the algorithm is going to punish you if you don't. But my first stream was like some fans had said, how can we help support you? And I was like, I don't know. And one of them told me about Patreon, which is crowdfunding per content. It was like a deliver your thing and get paid like a busker on the street with a hat playing guitar type of thing. And I was like, yeah, okay, I can get behind that. I didn't want to do sponsors or ads or any of that. So that organically just grew that way. I could afford to start taking a day off a week to work on it. And then slowly sponsors kind of just showed up, which was cool. I never pitched anybody. And then it was clear. I was like, well, I'm coming from a world of producers and networks and sponsors. I'm leaving that, or I'm doing my own thing. So I don't want this to become a thing I don't enjoy doing. So cool. I would love to have support and work with partners, but it can't be the whatever company show. Like, and what's cool is that it continues to be that the Patreon supporters are still the single largest support pillar. So I can tell any sponsor at any time, you're not number one. Like, I have a majority shareholder, which is the community, and that's, I'm making it for them, with them. And frankly, like, a lot of what I do is invitations from community members, like, come out and fly my thing or learn how to fly what I do. So a lot of what I've done is like just really cool opportunities. Like, I flew with the Coast Guard and just things like that, where it's like invited to go and, you know, explore their world, share their thing, and just tell their story to the community and just kind of be a conduit. So at any given time, I'm not doing one thing, and I'm not doing one thing that would be one focus. So it's fun to just share tons of aviation stories, and that's kind of what it evolved to become. So there was a time when my wife said, like, when was the last time you did a thing that wasn't flight chops? And I was like, yeah, I don't know. It's been more than 6 months. And she's like, what do you got booked that isn't flight chops? I was like, nothing. Because what I've been doing is pushing my contracts and other things to other friends. So I wasn't saying no to bookings.
Yeah.
I just wasn't taking them.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a moment where I decided I'm quitting. So that
kind of naturally happened.
Yeah.
Because I mean, the decision of actually quitting is difficult, right? Like, in your mindset, being like, you're stepping away, not easy money, but money that you went to school for, you worked your whole life for it, and saying no to that is kind of a big deal. So the fact that you were able to just kind of naturally say no is kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, it evolved that way. So bottom line, it isn't so much as that I left that world behind, because I think I took it with me, because I do put a lot of effort into the cutting and shooting. Like, I think a lot from a storytelling perspective. So I think that's what differentiates my content. I've had people ask me, like, how can I do what you do? It's like, well, okay, here's what you do. You got a pen, you go to film school, and you get your pilot license. And then for 20 years, you do both of those things separately, and then you merge them when the technology exists and the product, like publishing becomes democratized. Okay, so yeah, write that down and you go ahead and do that. I mean, it was such a unique situation where I did build my chops in film over decade, more than a decade really, by the time I was transitioning. So at the end of the day, I'm still doing what I was trained to do. I'm just blending it. So what's weird is like taking the fun flying aspect, I have to be very careful that I don't act as PIC while I got my filmmaker hat on. So I'm careful about that. If I'm PIC, the cameras are set it and forget it. And I don't, if I glance over and see a light off and a dead camera, it's like, well,
is what it is.
Yeah. And that happened to me coming into here. I had a very challenging Osh arrival. It's going to make a good video. One of the cameras died because I was up there so long. I was in the Fisk arrival for 2 hours this year. So I got enough of it that it'll work, I'm sure. But I did not, the person I was flying with actually asked me, like, do you want me to try to change this battery? I was like, nope. I need you to be eyes outside. We're not talking about film. Like, this is a nightmare. We are looking for traffic. It is so busy right now. We're not going to distract ourselves with camera batteries. That's not a thing. If we get it, we get it. Great. And then after landing, it's like, if we got it, that's awesome. Because we had a situation with like opposite direction traffic landing and everybody had to go around. Controllers were flustered. It was like, wow, that was a lot. And then of course, people on the ground got the shot, knew it was me because they saw the plane. So they've already sent it to me. So I have the shot from the ground of it happening. Yeah. So it'll work. But at the end of the day, in the air, I had to be a pilot. There's other times when I'm not PIC, I'm being trained. Then I can have fun as a filmmaker. I can try to be as much of a student pilot as I can. But a lot of those times, I'm frankly like a kid on daddy's lap, like holding the wheel and whatever crazy thing I'm getting to do. So I don't need to have the responsibility of being PIC. That said, I've also learned a variable that I have begun to realize is a thing, is that people will get distracted by the fact that it's me and my cameras are there and they'll make mistakes, which I'm now very cognizant of. Like, I have to calm them down and say, like, exactly what you did when we sat down for this podcast. It's like, we're just going to do our thing. And if we don't like something that happens, it's not going to, don't worry about that. We'll have the conversation later. We'll look at the rough cut. Because I've had things happen where we've taken off. Like, I flew with a very experienced pilot one time in a complex aircraft that I'm not checked out in. And I wasn't worried about being checked out in, but they put me left seat because they're an instructor, tons of time. Rigging cameras, things are busy, blah, blah, blah. We take off and I want to describe the type because I don't want to call them out.
Yeah.
But long story short, we're climbing out. Airspeed's not alive.
Oh boy.
Because we were busy and neither one of us checked it because I was trying to be eyes outside. Pitot covers were on.
Oh no.
So we flew away in a pretty complex aircraft with no airspeed indication because I didn't pay attention to his walk around. I didn't check airspeeds alive because I was trying to be his eyes outside fly this thing. So, and like he was too, because he was letting me do the takeoff. So we did a pattern in blankety blank type that was pretty complex with no airspeed.
What did that teach you about going into random people's airplanes?
I guess what I'm getting at is it taught me that I now don't let that happen where I don't not pay attention to the walk around. I ask them, even if we're not filming it, show me the walk around. And even if we're not worried about the run-up as being part of the video, I want you to talk me through that. Let's see the checklist. I want to see every item get done. I don't make it like I'm testing them, which I am. I'm making it like I want to learn it, which is also true. I'm probably not going to put the run-up in the video because we don't need that. We're here for whatever unique aspect of this thing, and I'll just, in the video, say run-up complete, whatever. But knowing what I know now, it's like items get missed they seem confident and capable, and in fact, they're distracted and stressed by this weird variable of me being this filmmaker guy that has some kind of a following, which I don't think about anymore, but they are. And I learned that the hard way. Luckily, it didn't go badly, but it could have.
Very easily. Yeah. I have a hesitation of getting in pretty much any other airplane that I don't feel comfortable in. Like, it's just things happen, you know? Like, could be the best pilot in the world. I flew 135 PC-12s and Caravans in Northeast Ohio. They own a bunch of DC-3s. The most qualified DC-3 pilot in the world. He crashed it and he died. It's like things happen, right?
Yeah.
Like, so it's very, when you bring that up, it's like, that's a big deal. Pitot covers, like, I would be a little upset, you know? It's like, come on, dude.
I was pretty disappointed, both in myself and the guy, but it also was sobering. And it's not something I'll ever forget. And I changed my SOPs about how I operate as Flight Chops going forward from that moment. And I've had a couple where I get invited to a thing and then you kind of get there and you start to realize like, this guy is really excited about this thing and it maybe isn't the right choice. And then you got to try to back out of it or try to figure out how to make that happen. So yeah, it's been interesting. Largely though, I mean, 98% of the time it's great. And people are just calm and do their thing. And it's awesome to learn from them or whatever. But yeah, I took that to heart as how to change how I operate.
How do you think you've changed either as a filmmaker, or storyteller from the beginning? Obviously, YouTube's a different beast, right?
Yep.
The community's a different beast. The community's evolving. It's getting younger now. There's more entrants and all that kind of stuff. But from you personally, how have you changed and what you're trying to do with this? Is it still the same? Just like you're just doing what you were taught in film school, just making a movie that you like, or has it changed a lot?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, yeah. I'm just trying to make the best content I can make that's authentic and relatable, telling a story while I'm doing it. I think the difference is I've just had a lot of opportunities that are diverse. Like if you told me when I started this that I was going to get to be a T6 pilot, like there were times when I saw things that I thought I will never get. Like I had the experience to sit in a T6 for the first time here, actually, in 2015 with Aeroshell. Bose set me up with that ride. It was one of my early sponsorships. And I remember climbing into it and I knew what it was and I knew it was the entry, you know, gateway drug to warbirds. And I also knew how hard the access is to those aircraft. And I felt like as I got in, I felt like I kept getting in. Like it's such a deep tunnel that you get in with the back of seat of a T6. And I said to myself, wow, this is a lot of airplane. And then the quiet part that didn't say was, and I'll never fly one. Like I'll never have the opportunity and I don't think I can handle it. And then cut to like 2018, I'm checked out as a T6 pilot. That type of thing gave me the opportunity to make content around things I never thought I would get access to. So that's really been the only change, but the fundamental way it works has been all the same.
Has it gotten harder at all or easier either way, like your formula or how you do things?
Yeah, that's a good question. It probably has gotten harder only in the sense that it's gotten more complex because the level of detail that the stories can become so deep in what I'm trying to do, I come back with a lot. Like I don't try to prescribe a story when I do something. It's like, okay, we're going to get to fly this aircraft at this place with this guy. Let's shoot it. And then all this awesome stuff happens and I come back with 2 terabytes of footage and it's like, oh boy. Whereas in the early days, it was like, we're going to do a briefing and we're going to do a flight. And I'm going to come back with like the flight and the briefing. I'm going to intercut those things and there it is. Boom. It's not that complicated. Now I got like the B-roll of the thing with the backstory and the guy, and we're at the place and we do the thing. It's got a really cool mission, whatever it is. And we fly the airplane. It's usually not just one flight because they usually want to deep dive and I get to do a few flights. So now I got nuances of all the things I learned across 3 flights. Do I make multiple episodes out of that? Do I try to make it into one? Is it too much to squeeze into one? I mean, we built the airplane. That was a whole thing of like covering the story of building it and test flying it, learning how to fly it. Deep dive stories. So how do I break those up? So yeah, it became harder, frankly, but the resources grew such that I could kind of manage it. But I would say it grew and got harder all at the same time, but the resources always were there just enough to match how hard it was, but it didn't make it easier to do the work.
I think it's surprising, not necessarily surprising, but I've noticed it too as, you know, more sponsors, you interview different people, maybe more prominent people than you have access to when you're first starting out, right? Like it can get a little bit harder. And it's not necessarily the pressure, but it's just the content, the story itself can be a little bit more complex than what you want to tell.
Yeah, I think also the audience, and maybe it's that everything is growing at the same time. In the early days, it wasn't hard to make good aviation content on YouTube because no one was really doing it. So I stood out just as like I was actually putting production value effort in without getting paid. Because I was able to fit in the time and that was my job. Now it seems like there's more access to better cameras that are cheaper. And I think kids are savvy to editing where people weren't. There's a lot of self-taught editors now that didn't exist before. And I think the standards have been raised so high. I'd like to think I had something to do with it a little bit, at least in this niche. So almost everybody knows if you're going to publish anything and expect any type of traction, you need it to not suck. Now, whether or not it has context is another story. That was a big goal of mine, was to publish stuff with context. Like I saw a lot of things in the early days that appeared to be instructional, but I knew it was wrong. Like I remember seeing a video of a guy demonstrating stalls and spins in a 172, and he was like using aileron in the recovery. And it's like, okay, that's wrong. I'm not an instructor, but I know that's wrong. I don't know who this guy is, but he's presenting it as instruction, and that's dangerous. So I just decided I'm going to do a thing that I'm presenting it clearly as a private pilot, just trying to get better. I'm going to put it out there as like a learning moment, and you do what you want with it, but don't treat it as instruction. Ideally, take it with you to like start the conversation that you can finish with your instructor. That was kind of the context that I tried to set aside and do my thing. And I think I dodged any of the bullets of like confusion or regulatory problems by just making it clear, like, I'm not trying to teach anybody anything other than just share a learning moment.
How many times have you had the FAA version of Canada or anything like that? Like, Steve, what you doing, buddy?
None.
That's good.
I've heard that I've had complaints that have been kind of mitigated or bounced off people because there's been enough people on my side. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I haven't had the phone call.
That's good.
Yeah, I work hard though because I do work with consultants and other friends. Like I always show my stuff to a CFI or I show it to the collaborator who's usually a professional, you know, and if it's me as PIC, I show it to one of my instructors to be like, am I getting anything wrong here? Or am I setting myself for any kind of, am I vulnerable here with anything? And that usually it's worked out. So
yeah. Does that make you nervous at all? Just the fact that like if someone does like one comment, right, can take you at, not take you down, but can bring the wrong set of eyes to what you're doing.
Yeah, I think the good news is I think the wrong eyes are watching anyways, so I think I'm being watched.
You're like, AdSense, keep watching, please.
Well, not only that, it's just I know they're watching, so I don't worry about them, like the regulatory people watching me, because I just try to make it clear, like, I'm safety-minded and I'm not doing anything. I'm very clearly not doing it as a selfie thing. Like, I think flying is cool as it is. Nothing about what I'm doing is trying to act cool. I might be humble to a fault, I've been told, because I probably should own some of the experience that I've got. I still don't feel like I have any right to talk with any authority about any of it because I do so much different things. I'm a jack of all trades, like master of none, but I do have more than 50 hours in a T6. And I think that's something that not a lot of people have, but I still don't want to tell you how to fly a T6. And I might in a conversation over a beer, give you some insights of what, you know, but I'm not going to try to tell you with authority. So with that in mind, like it's just do it the best you can and share it honestly. And I don't share it like it's perfect. You know, I just try to share what I really learned.
Has there been a moment when you're, for me with the podcast, like every once in a while, there's like a dang, like, I don't know if I want to, like every once in a while, you're like, dang, this kind of sucks. Like it's not as fun as it was. Let's take a break from today's episode to hear from our sponsor, RAA. Now you and I both know that a pilot's life moves faster than most. So it's no surprise that financial planning for the future can take a backseat to the nonstop job in front of us. The airline specialized financial advisors, RAA, get that, which is why they've created a free, complete financial planning guide exclusively for those who fly. It outlines the 7 key factors you'll want to consider when preparing a sound financial plan for tomorrow and simplifies complex money topics that matter to you most, both in the near term and further down the line, including investment management strategies, maximizing your income and savings, ways to save on taxes, determining how much you'll need to retire, and much, much more. The Essential Planning Guide is easy to follow and, best of all, free. So don't let another day pass by without discovering the proven financial steps you can take now to plan for what's next. Download your free copy of RAA's Complete Financial Planning Guide today at raa.com/pilottopilot. That's raa.com/pilottopilot. Now back to today's episode.
Happens all the time.
Yeah.
And even with AirVenture, this arrival, I was feeling the same way. Like I just wanted to show, I literally just published an episode 2 weeks prior from my previous year where I had a normal arrival that's still ridiculous, like how that approach looks, but it all went smoothly, if you want to call it that. And I had a pretty good interview with one of the main people here. So he's one of the guys that writes it. And he kind of pretty clearly said, like, if you get sent around, they're going to work you back into the pattern and, you know, you'll be on the ground probably within 2 minutes. It's not likely you'll be sent away to start again. It's going to be okay. It's not in the NOTAM because it's hard to establish every possible go around scenario, but don't worry about it. Da, da, da. So I made that a big message of the video. And then this episode, this arrival, I got sent around and basically hung out to dry. So I want to talk to the AA and kind of brief that and figure it out. I'm going to talk to him, but we'll have a laugh about it because the fact is, there you go. Like they can't cover every scenario. But I got basically the instruction I got was everybody go around. And that meant someone else went around too with me on final. And then we got sent, they said, go back to FISC. It's like, that's not a thing. Going back to FISC is not a thing. So now I made the turn to go back to FISC because that's what I told to do. And I immediately realized I've just violated the departure procedure because I'm higher than 1300. I'm not going south. And right about that moment, someone on frequency said, Charlie Golf Alpha, you on frequency? Because I guess they could see me on ADS-B going God knows where. And I was like, yeah, I knew I was about to get in trouble. And they're like, you're going the wrong way. You need to go south. I'm like, So I just climbed out. And I'm thinking to myself, like, well, that's that video pooched. But now I'm thinking I'm going to share that because that was an honest moment of me reacting to the information I had, which is in my mind, I'm thinking they're going to work me back in, right? Like, wait, what? Go back to Fisk? I can't go to Fisk. That's not a thing. So I'm on my way there because that's what they told me to do. So I need to say to them, like, you can't tell people to go to Fisk. You need to say, fly their departure and get out of here and start again, or work them in the pattern. That's your two options. So don't tell them the third thing. I don't know. I'm sure that controller was just kind of flustered because that guy landed in the wrong direction and completed his landing. And it was weird. But there you go. Like, so at the end of the day, this is why I don't think about it at the time. I just do the thing and then find the story in post.
As you've done this, how many videos have you done?
Over 200.
Over 200.
Yeah.
Are there any that have never been released? Are you sitting on some and just like, this is awful, I'll never release it?
No. I think anything that I've gone through the effort of editing has usually worked out. There's definitely footage that has been like, that didn't go anywhere. And it's not because it's bad necessarily. It's just because it's just one of those cases where the work to do it was too much right now. I mean, I'm still sitting on stuff going back as long as 2018. And some of them are like 90% cut. I just got busy. The pipeline got things in the way. I've still got stuff from flying the Beaver in Alaska that I'm still, it's good. It's timeless stuff. But my daughter is like way younger and I have less gray hair. But it's still like, it's a Beaver. It's a classic aircraft in Alaska. There's nothing dated about that. But I'd be curious to see what the audience thinks of something from 2018.
It'd be interesting to see how you change. You know, you release more relevant videos and they go back to 2018 and see your style flying and who you are.
Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, I don't think it changes much.
Yeah.
Other than the lack of gray hair in the kid that's a
baby.
Is
the gray hair from the kid or from the video?
I mean, that's kind of the joke is like having the baby. It was really the pregnancy where I was stressed out. I think the kid has been so easy.
Yeah.
No, my hair turned gray during the pregnancy, I think. I was just so worried about that going badly.
Oh, yeah. Get that.
It's a tough time.
I have a 19-month-old, so.
I know. Yeah. Following your stuff. Yeah. I know.
Get that, man. It's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pregnancy was really scary. It's like, I have no control over what's going to happen. So many things go wrong.
Yeah. As a pilot, it just was like trying to mitigate every possible risk, and you can't.
Not at all.
Yeah.
So you released, that's cool. I have one episode that I've never released. So I was wondering if there's like one that you're like, I cannot do this. Like, I just cannot.
I have so many sitting in the bank that may never get released, but it's not because they're not good. It's just because I haven't put them in the pipeline.
How many times has the idea of what you want to say in a story versus what you actually tell change, like throughout the actual video?
Yeah.
Like,
well, I don't typically have a really intense message narrative necessarily dialed in because oftentimes what happens. I think a great example of that is an early, early one. I took a friend to basically help her get over her fear of flying. And her boyfriend is a director. So he flew in the back and we knew what video we were making. We were going to go flying on a beautiful sunset, calm air, and we were going to blow her mind and she was going to get out of the airplane and be no longer afraid of flying. 100%, that's the video we were making. That video became about how when you're distracted and stupid, you fly into the wake of a Dash 8. That's what that video became. And it was a great example of her fear becoming self-fulfilling. She was so distracting. She was so scared. It didn't get better. The whole time, she looked like an animal. Like, her eyes were just... I know her really well. And knowing what I know now, like, most people who are truly afraid of flying just won't get in an airplane. She did it because of knowing me for years and her boyfriend, like, let's make this, it'll be okay. She did it despite the fear that was intense. Nothing about that flight was ever going to get through that. And in fact, debriefing it later, she told me the air was so calm, she thought at any moment we were going to just fall to our deaths.
Really?
Because nothing was holding the airplane up.
Huh.
And then when we hit the wake, so basically I called the flight like from the city. Like, I was like, this is not working. So I called the tower to say, I'd like direct threshold if I can get it. Like, we're done. And they're like, well, okay, we'll put you in between these Dash 8s, just, you know, caution wake turbulence. Done this a million times. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Hit wake turbulence, right?
Well, I always know to fly a steep approach. Like, I know to just change my approach. No problem. I've done this a million times. I know how they fly their approaches. I don't need the whole runway. I'm going to fly steep. I'm going to land past the point they touch down. I won't touch their wake. No problem. I do this all the time. She was so distracting. I just locked into a normal approach and just completely ignored that wake turbulence warning I'd gotten 60 seconds ago and flew right into the wake. And, you know, the airplane did what airplanes do when you hit a wake. I luckily didn't get flipped over upside down, but at like 50 feet, I hit from totally calm air. I hit a pretty intense wake, saved it. I didn't go around. Being a glider pilot, I'm pretty commonly, and I get instructors often tell me, like, why did you save that? And it's like, because my primacy is you get one shot, which isn't necessarily a good thing. But in this case, it was, because she told me, like, if you, after that happened, if you added power and started going, I would have clawed your face off and opened the door. And I'm like, and I know that. I could tell that you were like a cat. She was like a wild cat, the way she looked. So we completed that landing, and I felt so bad because of that. But she said, oh, no, that was fine. At that point, I knew we were going to crash, and I was only going to break my arm. Because she figured that we were definitely going to crash, but it was going to be okay, like just sort of tumbling, kind of cartwheeling crash. Whereas over the city, she was like, we are going to fall out of the sky and be like a ball of flames in the city. Like, nothing is holding this airplane up. But if she had told me that in the air, she could have articulated it, I would have just slowed to 80, dropped some flaps, and said, open the window. It's the 172. It's concrete out there. Like, we are solid. But it was so calm. Anyway, the part two of that was I sent her with a female instructor friend in a Redbird. I said, go try to work that out. And that actually helped her. She went, you know, knowing she's on the ground in a moving simulator with a female instructor, nice calm environment, and she got to actually fly the airplane and look at what a stall is and what does it mean to have airflow over the wings. And that helped her with logic a bit, but the fact is, like, true fear of flying is not something you mess with, and I was so stupid to think I could take that on. So that's the story I use as a case of where I learned, don't plan a video.
Yeah.
Because that ain't going to work out.
Absolutely. I can only imagine that. Yeah. That situation. I'm surprised it hasn't happened.
So that's an early one, and it's like somewhere near a million views now.
Really?
Yeah. It's some 2015 or something.
Is there a video that you released that, not necessarily you weren't proud of, because you said everything you do, you put a lot of work into it, and it's good. But one that you were surprised that got the viewership it did?
Yep.
Yeah.
So the most popular video on my channel is, again, it was another one from Bose that they offered. They're like, you can go fly the B-29. Like, you can't fly it, but you can be in it. And I was like, honestly, not really. Like, my thing is about stick time and being in the seat, but that's a pretty cool opportunity, so I'm going to take it. So I was like, how can I make this interesting? So I got the permission to put cameras everywhere like I do, including the cockpit. I was like, I want intercom audio. I want to follow the procedures. I want to see it all happening, but I can't even be in the seats up there. And I said, what seat can I be in to give me freedom to move once it's flying? And they're like, it's one of the more boring seats, honestly. It's in the middle. And I'm like, cool, because once it's flying, I can move. Because the person in the best seat, quote unquote, is like the nose. But you can't move because you're not allowed to go between the crew. So I was like, I don't want that seat. They pay a lot of money for that seat anyways. So I was like, it's not even on the table for me to have that seat. But I was like, cool. So that's the video. I was like, all right, I'm gonna interview the crew, whatever, talk about the B-29. And then I called it like crawling through a B-29 in flight, whatever. And then I made a little silly icon of my logo, like bouncing around from every single station in the airplane while it's flying, intercutting it with the crew doing their thing. So you hear them doing their thing, the whole startup, the whole flying, how it works, the engineer does his thing, the pilot doesn't really even manipulate the engines at certain times because the engineer's doing it. It was interesting. It was a stretch, I think, from what I typically do. But that video is approaching 10 million views. And I don't know that it's helped the channel, frankly, because it got so wide outside the niche that I think it just confused YouTube as far as like,
who am I? Who is this guy?
Who is this guy? And it started putting my content out in front of the people that clicked that video. And that video has terrible retention because I think 8 million of those people clicked on a video that they thought was like about the Millennium Falcon. And a lot of comments in the video say like, wow, that cockpit looks just like the Millennium Falcon, which I say 90 seconds into the video that George Lucas was inspired by that cockpit for the Millennium Falcon because they didn't make it to 90 seconds because they watched the first minute realizing, oh no, this is a nerdy aviation video. I don't want to watch this.
Yeah.
So it got a lot of clicks, didn't get retention, and yet the algorithm kept feeding it. So I have thought many times about taking that video down. It's just like, don't feel like it's representative of the channel in terms of the audience that it reached. But I haven't because I'm proud of it, and I do feel like it did a lot for them as far as the charity of the commemorative Air Force that runs the aircraft. So, but that's a weird anomaly.
Yeah, that is really interesting to think about. Something that could be the biggest video you do, but the actual impact it has in your community is probably the least amount.
Yeah, I don't think it did a lot for my channel. Yeah.
Outside of AdSense, maybe. But
no, because it didn't have a ton of retention.
Oh, so not even retention.
I guess the fact is, even crappy retention on 10 million views, I should look at what the total revenue is on it. It's probably something, but it's not what you think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Looking at, going back to your wife, I like to give wives the credit because my wife's awesome. She supported me a lot. This was her idea for me to start this in a certain way. But how crucial has the support and kind of a rock been in doing this whole thing? Even from the beginning when you essentially had three jobs, right? You were husband, film, you actually had your film career and you had this.
Yeah.
So three jobs, now flight shop, still dad, husband. Yeah. How is that?
Yeah, it's huge. So, I mean, she was the stable force. She's a teacher, so she kind of had the real job. And when I would do my crazy, goofy traveling, whatever I would do like this, like I'm gone now for 12 days because directly after this trip, I'm going to an aerobatic camp where I'm going to get working on competitive sequence training from the ground where they spot you and try to make sure you're looking good in the box, that kind of stuff. So I'll be gone for like 12, 13 days. That's a lot. And she holds down the fort. So, I mean, we got a kid, we got a dog. It's a lot. So to know like that you have that is, I couldn't do it if I didn't have that support, frankly. Like I couldn't leave the other life, or I wouldn't have the other life, I guess. I could be a guy without a family and then do whatever I want. So to have both is a pretty tough thing to pull off. I think a lot of pilots have to fight that battle to travel and do what they do for work and know there's a home to come back to.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. It's definitely tough. And having that support makes life a lot easier.
Yeah.
For sure.
The other day you were talking about like trying to fit it in at the end of the day. And I just knew it's been a hot day. I've been outside all day. I just know my brain is not going to function. And that's a part of this too, is like trying to be flight chops. The pressure is high.
Yeah.
I need to perform as a pilot. Yeah. Like I did. So yesterday I got up super early to film with Jessica Cox, who she's the pilot with no arms. She's currently working on a control setup for a custom built RV-10. All of her controls are going to be on the floor. Basically, she currently flew a Eurocoupe where she had to like fly cross-legged to make the controls as existing work for her. And she was able to do it, like operate the radio, the whole thing with her legs crossed. It's nuts. So she's customizing this aircraft and she has a simulator in the home build hangar that you can go fly. I suggest you go try it. It's pretty awesome. You have to fly with your feet, take your shoes off. You got to use your toes, the whole thing. But I interviewed her. I watched her do it. And then she's like, you have to fly this. I'm like, yeah, I have to fly this. I know. And I handed my camera to one of my guys that was with me. And it's like, that's a lot of pressure. It's like, okay, let's see how this goes. Amazingly, I was able to land it. But I think it's partly because I do so many different types of flying. But the pressure is there to perform and be sharp mentally to do all this at the same time as like be that guy, to be present. I don't consider myself outgoing. I'm definitely an introvert.
Mm-hmm,
so same. To be in front of the camera and have to do that, that's a lot. So you have to be aware when you're done. So like at 6 p.m. after starting at 6 a.m. that day, I knew like, nah, we're not going to do this.
No, definitely not. I was in the same boat. Don't worry. Yeah. It didn't offend me at all. I was like, all right, cool. See you tomorrow.
Yeah.
And kind of going off that, like a typical week of Oshkosh, like just walking around, what's that like for you? Like, is it stressful? Like people coming up to you or like?
I think what's stressful to me is when they ask me to sign things. So what I do is I write, keep your flight chops sharp in quotes, dash Steve. I don't give them my signature because I don't feel like my signature is worth anything. So I feel like my slogan is like practice and stay sharp, that kind of thing. I don't feel like I'm worthy of like the celebrity thing. So it is that here, but I'm thankful that it's not that. There have been a couple times in real life. It's a handful, often at airports. So my family knows when we're traveling, it's probably going to happen. But a couple times in real life it happened. It's like, wow, I cannot even imagine being an actual celebrity. Like at one point I was walking down the street in my neighborhood and a cop car did that thing where they like diagonally jumped the curb. And I'm like, I am getting arrested. I'm obviously, they must have me mixed up or something. And the passenger cop was like face palming. And the driver was like, flight chops. Like, dude, man.
You scared the crap.
You jumped the curb in front of me. But I mean, you know, they're just so used to that's how they roll, right? So whatever. You know, that kind of thing. It's what I ultimately, I guess it's what I signed up for. And it's really rewarding when people want to tell me, like, you helped me decide not to quit, or you helped me decide to get another rating that I didn't necessarily need, but then it made me so much better, or whatever. That's kind of my thing, is like, even if you don't think you need a multi-rating, go get it or whatever, or just get tailwheel. I don't know. You may not use it, but it's fun and it will make you better in all your other flying. So that's kind of my motto. And when I'm walking around, that's what the interactions typically are.
Yeah.
So I like that.
Does your family watch your videos at all? Does your wife
not
watch
really.
Your videos?
Yeah. Not really. You're like, she's my biggest fan that doesn't watch my stuff.
All right. Isn't that funny? Yeah.
And I don't even want them to. Like, it's like, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
My daughter, sometimes she's at the age now where kids, they all want to be YouTubers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, sometimes she like tries to show her friends the videos. It's like, not a good idea. I mean, they're cool, but they're also deep dives.
Yeah.
So there's going to be like, usually I start off with a few minutes of like a cool montage of like the thing, but then we're going to the thing. So
we're nerding out. Yeah.
If you're not ready for like learning how to operate a beaver.
Yeah.
In Alaska with like a lot of complicated fuel systems, then you're not going to want to watch the next 20 minutes or whatever. I try to keep them under 20 typically, but some of those ones go to 25 Yeah.
Yeah. Last thing I got for you before rapid fire. What's something that maybe you don't get the, you obviously have your kind of video persona. People know you as that. What's something that might surprise them about you, like a family life, dad life, or who you are that maybe people don't know or cannot be portrayed over those videos?
I mean, I got to be honest. I think I don't hide or be what I'm not. So that's why when we first walked in the room, I was like, don't ask me questions you're going to ask me, because I'm not going to answer it the second time naturally. So I can't. I'm not a performer. So that's me. You really do see me in the videos.
That's good. Okay. That's good to know. Yeah. I didn't know, because a lot of times people, you know, that camera comes on and they try to be like this whole new person.
Can't do it. It's exhausting. That is exhausting.
Yeah. It's exhausting.
So therefore I won't do it.
Yeah.
So then it becomes backwards exhausting when I get pre-interviewed, because I'm like, you just took it. So now I'm going to have to try to answer that question again, and it will not.
And you're thinking so hard. Yep. Yeah.
So I don't want to do it. So that's what I always do. So for my videos, even when I'm working with someone, I haven't got the camera out of the bag yet, and they're so excited to start talking about the thing. I'm like, tell me about your dog. Tell me about the cottage. I don't know, but don't tell me about the thing. Yeah.
We'll talk about this.
I'm going to ask you about the thing, and you're going to tell me about the thing, and the camera's going to be rolling, and the first take is going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
The second take won't.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something about being natural, right? That's like when I do these, I don't know. I try not to know anything about anyone. I just ask whatever you give me, I'll ask a question based off of. So I think that's the best way to do it.
Yeah, you need to know a certain degree just so you don't like not
you
know
miss something.
The universe they're in.
Yeah.
But let them tell the minutiae,
Yep, exactly. Well, cool. Well, I got some rapid fire questions. Let me get my phone out real quick. What's your favorite airplane ever made?
Spitfire.
What about like a jet, like corporate jet or airline jet if you have one?
I mean, Gulfstreams are cool. Yeah. I don't really know jets.
Yeah. You're going to get into jets one day, you know?
No.
No? Flight chops in the jet world.
Not really.
What's the ugliest airplane you've ever seen?
That's a tough one, because even unique aircraft I think are cool. I mean, maybe the Boomerang, the Rutan, I think asymmetry drives me crazy, but the fact that Rutan thought that works and does, that's cool. But yeah, I guess the Boomerang.
What's one airplane that you haven't had the opportunity to fly yet that you'd want to fly?
Yeah, so the Spitfire, but I want to show up prepared to do the checkout. I don't want to ride. So I've had the offer for a ride. I'm like, nope. I'm waiting until I have more than 50 hours T6 time. I want to show up and get the checkout.
Is there one plane you've flown and you never want to fly again?
Oh, okay. I don't want to offend Kyle. I love Kyle Fowler. I got to fly the Long Easy, the one that flies in the show here.
Yeah.
It's just uncomfortable, man. It's amazing design, but no, that wasn't for me.
What's something you wish you knew before you became a pilot?
There's so much, man. That's a tough one. I mean, I guess the thing is, the challenge of staying current and how fast it erodes. It's not like riding a bike. People say that. It's like, no, it is not. If you're not doing it regularly, it's fundamental stay, but a lot of the basics fade and you make stupid mistakes.
If you were to start kind of flying again, flight chops again, do you think it would turn into what it is now? Or do you think the market is completely different? And it would obviously look a little bit different, but do you think you could turn it into what it is right now?
Yeah, so no. I mean, what I did happened largely because of when it happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Favorite thing about aviation?
I think the community.
Yeah. Who's someone in the industry you'd like to meet most? Someone maybe that's died or still
alive? Hoover.
Bob Hoover, there you go.
I did meet him, but didn't get to know him the way I wish I could have.
I got about 100 hours on a Shrike. It was a terrible plane on the one I was flying, so not something to brag about, but his was much better. Yeah. What's the hardest approach you've ever flown or hardest flight you've ever flown?
Hardest flight. There's been a lot. I'm going to say like the arrival here this weekend was in the ballpark of one of the most difficult because I almost bailed. Like I almost was like,
Toronto, here we go.
Stopped having fun. Well, I wasn't going to go home, but I was going to be like, I'm not going in today. It stopped being fun. It was challenging. And
what's your favorite airport to land at?
Favorite airport? Toronto Island has got a great approach. It's like, it would have been like Meigs Field, like right there beside Toronto, lit up at dusk. You got the whole city skyline. You're right there. It's awesome.
Least favorite airport?
Least favorite airport. I can't say I have a particular least favorite airport.
IFR, VFR, what would you rather fly?
Okay, so I love everything. I got the airplane that I got very specifically because it does really well with IFR. Mm-hmm. But then I built in a fun switch into the panel so I can kill the ESP and go fly upside down. So IFR to travel, VFR for fun.
That's a good answer. That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Would you rather fly over mountains, cities, or the beach?
Beach.
What's your favorite airport food? So let's say you're doing a cross country, you're flying for fun, you're stopping out, are you getting barbecue, you salad guy, burger guy, what are you getting?
I'm getting like a clubhouse sandwich with like fresh cut fries that aren't coated. You know the coated fries that are from the freezer? No. Yeah. I want fresh cut fries and a nice healthy clubhouse with like real turkey.
Yeah. Long trips or short trips? So like the longest flight you can fly or as many short legs?
I'm going until I want to pee, which is like 3 hours.
Yeah, that's how I am too. What was the hardest check ride you had?
Instrument. Well, you know what? Instrument check ride wasn't hard. It was the friggin' written test that killed me. Yeah.
Biggest regret of your career, if you have one.
All right. So biggest regret, I got to be honest, like I've been so unfocused and done a lot of things. I don't have a lot of regrets because I couldn't be what I am if I didn't fail to commit to anything. So I'm good. It's like, I kind of wish that I could have figured it out sooner, but I don't think I could have figured it out sooner. So it is what it is.
Biggest win of your career?
Biggest win, I think just figuring out or getting the opportunity to become a T6 pilot, because that opened up the doors, and just to be able to do that is amazing.
If you're, let's say you got a nice long, you got a nice vacation with the wife and kid, what airline are you going on? You got first class tickets. What are you choosing?
Airline?
You can't fly yourself. What airline are you going on? You're going to like Bali.
I don't know, like KLM or something. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Those are the rapid fire questions. I actually lied to you. I have one more question. It won't be too hard though. You did mention how people ask you how they can be you. And one, I think it's important that you can't be you, right? No. You are you. You, everyone can do their own, like maybe they're inspired by you, but do it their own way. It's impossible to be you. They just can't do it. What do you recommend for the number one tip for someone that wants to be successful in this? What would you recommend?
As a content creator?
Yeah, as a content creator today, starting now.
It's tough, man. Like, I don't know what to say about starting now. It is very hard. There's total saturation. Mm-hmm. It's really been migrating toward clickbait. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to make quality content and break through. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky to do it when I did it. And again, that's what I talk about. Like, I couldn't have figured it out sooner because the technology didn't exist. And when I did get it figured out, the window was there to do it the way I did it, which was authentic long form content that didn't lean on clickbait. So I don't know, man. It is really like it's hard. It would be hard to start now.
Yep. Agreed. That's it. I mean, that's perfect. I agree.
Okay.
Yeah. I totally agree. Steve, Flight Chops, thanks so much. It was a lot of fun. Great time. We'll do it some other time. Maybe I mentioned a couple of years ago, we'll do it on a plane sometime. We can do some, come up to Toronto and fly around and do it there.
Cool. Okay, T6.
Yeah, let's make it happen. All right. Cool. Thanks, man, so much. Appreciate it.
Awesome.
See you. Aviation, that is a wrap on today's podcast. Again, shout out to Bold Aviator. Check out boldaviator.com to get your best and high quality aviation gear. They're the ones that make the Pilot to Pilot hats and they're high quality. So check them out. Great stuff. Shout out to Steve for coming on the podcast. I recorded my first video podcast I've ever done with Fly with Big Earn. He has been requested by everyone here. So we got him. He's on. I don't know if I'll do the full video on YouTube, but we might have some clips. So we're working with a studio. Might not look great to start out with, but we will get better. So be on the lookout for that. So Aviation, that's all I have for you today. Have a great day. And as always, happy flying.